That a lot of us suffer from attention deficit disorder. Well, Rami, you have to raise your hand on that for that. But a lot of us suffer from that. Mother took her son to the doctor and said to the doctor, "Doctor, I'm here to get medication. My son has been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder." Doctor turns to the kid and says, "Son, how long have you had it? He answered him, "I'm going bowling tonight." But giving out medication is not such a simple thing. A lot of doctors like to prescribe medication, think it's going to solve all of our problems. Like the novice pharmacist who had to cover for his boss, wanted to step out for a few moments, said, "Are you sure you can handle it? You watched me long enough." He said, "Yeah, it's no problem." Goes out, takes his lunch break, "Put away the phones, please." And the guy comes in and says, "I have a terrible cough, can you help me? I need some cough medicine." The guy's looking around, he can't find the cough medicine. So instead of giving cough medicine, he gives him a box of laxatives. So a few minutes later, the boss comes back and he says, "Everything okay? You handled?" "Yeah, it's okay, but just the guy came, I couldn't find the cough medicine, so I gave him laxatives instead." He said, "What are you doing? That's not gonna help him. That's gonna..." He goes, "What do you mean? Look at him. He's standing over there, nervously standing by the wall. That guy is afraid to cough. Look at him."
That's good. That was a good one.
Okay. A few important... First of all, announcement that I forgot from this morning. I don't like to say announcements now, but this morning I forgot to mention that next Shabbos is our first out Shabbos Shabbaton. We're going out as a yeshiva to a community. On the schedule, it said Kochav HaShachar, which we'll be doing later on in the year. They couldn't take us this year, so we're going to go on later in the year. But this next Shabbos, we're going to go to Beit Shemesh for Shabbos. Actually, to the neighborhood that I live in, Rabbi Amalei, Rabbi David. So if anyone, for some reason, is not able to join us for that Shabbos, please let us know now, because we're setting you up in families. Also, if you have a family that your cousins are there, or whatever, your aunt and uncle, friends, relatives, that are in Beit Shemesh, that you'd like to stay with them, it also would help us in terms of finding a place for 120 guys. So if you have a place that you would like to stay, so please also let us know, and so we can coordinate properly. Okay, tonight's going to be very different than this morning. This morning was heavy, very serious, as it should have been. Tonight, on a little lighter note, but I think the message is no less important. A number of questions, when you look at this week's Parsha, especially when you contrast it to Parsha's Noach, to last week's Parsha, a number of questions become very, very striking, right off the bat. First of all, we understand, we get a little introduction in Parshas Noach. We get an introduction that Noach is a tzaddik, ish tamim, tamim ayyavad arasav, es elokim esalach Noach. We can understand why Noach is chosen to be the man. Why he's chosen to build the ark, the world's going to be saved through his hands. We understand. He's special. He's different than everybody else. But then you come to this week's Parsha, and without any introduction to Avram whatsoever, to Avram, "Vayomer Hashem el Avram, lech lecha me'aretzcha me'aretzcha ve'yisavicha el aretz hasherecha." Who is Avram? Who is it? Torah doesn't tell us anything about him. The end of last week's Parsha, which we'll talk about in a second, the end of the Parsha, it mentions that he was the son of Terach, and they're traveling, they're leaving Ur Kasdim, they come to Haran, but doesn't tell us anything about his tzidkus, anything special about... Why not? Why does the Torah tell us? Why is Avram chosen without any introduction whatsoever. Doesn't seem worthy from reading the simple reading of the Psukim. That's question number one. Question number two, very related question, is that we know why Avram was chosen. Or we think we know. We learned from the time we were in kindergarten, we learned about the stories about Avram, about destroying the idols of his father, and about being thrown into the Kibshon HaEsh, and about, if you've read the Rambam in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, in introduction to Hilchos Avodah Zarah, the first paragraph of Hilchos Avodah Zarah tells us how Avram came to find God in a time when everyone was worshipping idols, how he himself discovered God, Zemachlokes, whether he was 3, whether he was 48 years old, Machlokes in Chazal. Whatever the case may be, we have all these stories, amazing stories, which we've grown up with, which maybe when we were younger we thought were written in the Torah, and then as we got older, or this year, we'll discover that it actually is not written in the Torah. Where is it? There's no stories. Where is it? The question is, why? Why did the Torah tell us these things? Why did the Torah itself? We understand it's the Torah Shebaal Peh. Now we believe, we, Jewish people believe in the Torah, believe that the Torah was given with the Torah Shebaal Ktav and the Torah Shebaal Peh. We believe, now some Midrashim, this is a topic, a larger topic, I think Rabbi Affel is going to be dealing with it in his 6th year, a larger topic, but some Midrashim are meant to be taken literally, some Midrashim are meant to be taken figuratively. Okay, but these are stories that are brought down in Chazal, and the Rambam, who's the champion of telling us when to be taken literally, when to be taken figuratively, he takes these stories literally. So these stories happened. So why didn't the Torah tell us these stories about Avram? We can understand why he was chosen. Why did the Torah itself tell us this? Why didn't the Torah tell us how Avram came to discover God? Is this not the most important information we would want to know? How Avram came on his own, through his own thinking and discovery and analysis, to come to discover God? Isn't that like, that would be the greatest thing to know? This is a sort of in parentheses. Maybe I'll tell the longer story another time. But I was once, I mentioned to some of you, Uri Zohar, the guy when I was subbing for Rabbi Schneider. Uri Zohar was the most famous Baal Tshuva in the history of the state of Israel, modern state of Israel. Uri Zohar, still alive today, very interesting person. He was the most famous media personality at the time when he decided to give up the life of parties and women and drink and all of his fame and fortune to become a religious observant Jew. And I was once watching a video. I came to this place, the rabbi was supposed to speak, he was late, so while waiting for the rabbi, they put on this video. The video of Uri Zohar telling his story of how he came to discover God. To make a long story short, he was at a party, and Rabbi Grossman from Migdal HaEmek, if you know who he is, he came to this party in the middle of like this in Tel Aviv with, again, scantily dressed women, a lot of liquor and probably a lot of weed, and he comes into the middle of this party and he says to these famous people, he says, "What would you say if I could prove to you without beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's a God in the world? Would you be interested in listening?" So they start making fun of him. And you know, come on, Rabbi, get out. There's no way you can prove this. But Uri Zohar sort of sobered up for a minute. He said, I'd be willing to hear it. There's no way you can prove it to me. But if you can prove it to me, I'll be willing to hear it. So he said, okay, here, this is not the place right now. You're not lucid right now. You'll come to me and he's telling the story in the video. And he says, so I finally came to him. I said, can you imagine if you really can prove to me that beyond the shadow of a doubt that there's a God in the world? And I meet him in this place, and he begins to explain to me, and prove to me beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's a God in the world. And then I'm watching this video. There's about 200 people in this ulam auditorium, And they someone gets up and they turn off the video and says, okay, the rabbi is here. And they roll off the screen and the rabbi, I'm like, just finish this. This is the most important information you can ever find out. It's going to prove to me on the Shabbat that there's a God in the world. And they just rolled it off and never, and everyone was okay with it. It was very funny at the time. Anyway, so isn't this the most important information? Wouldn't you want to know the rest of that video? Wouldn't you want the Torah to include how Avram came to discover God? And yet the Torah doesn't include it. Why not? Why doesn't the Torah tell us all those amazing stories? That's question number two. Question number three. Now this, I need you to concentrate on this one. Okay? This is going to take, remember calculus? Okay?
No.
It's gonna take a lot of cheshbonin here. Okay? But this question I'm going to share with you now, maybe one of the most difficult questions you will ever hear about the Torah. One of the most difficult questions. It's such a difficult question that most Bible critics don't even know this question. But if they did, they would be dancing up and down about this question. It's a very, very difficult question. And we're going to try to answer it. I have to admit to you, the question is better than the answer. But I think we have a way to solve some of the mystery. But here's the question. And I should have brought a Torah with me. Is there a Tanakh in the house? Let's see if you can help us out with this question. Question is as follows. How old was Abraham when God tells him, Lech Lecha? In the beginning of this week's Parsha. 75 years old. Excellent. Okay, so Abraham is 75 years old, beginning of this week's Parsha. When he's told, thank you. I'll take that also. Thank you. When he's told Lech Lecha, it's in here. And here. Now, the Torah tells us also in Parshas Bo that the Jewish people were slaves for how many years? The Torah in Parshas Bo. Who?
400.
To get closer?
240.
430. Okay, the pasuk is Perek Yud Bet, Pasuk Dalet. Torah says, wrong pasuk. One second.
Let's put a pause on that record.
12:40, that's what. 12:4. Yud Bet, Pasuk Dalet is in this week's parasha. And then in Pasuk, Perek Yud Bet, Pasuk Mem. It says, "Umosha b'nei Yisrael asher yashu b'Mitzrayim, 30 shana v'arba mi'ot shana." 430 years they sat in Mitzrayim. Okay, now we're good. So far, we have Abram was 75 when he was told Lech Lecha. 430 years the Jewish people were in Mitzrayim. There's a problem for 400, to say 430. Rashi points out the problem here because in the end of our parsha, V'Lech Lecha, we have the Bris Ben Habsarim. And Hashem tells Avram that your nation, your children, are going to be a foreign nation in a land, foreign land, for how long? For 400 years. 400 years, but the Torah says they were 430 years in Mitzrayim. So Hashem says they're going to be 400 years. They were 430 years. So Rashi reconciles this difficulty. This is not even the difficulty part. Rashi reconciles the difficulty of 430 and 400. This the Bible critics do pick up on, by the way. But Rashi was before them. And he says 430 is counting from Bris Ben Habsarim, and 400 is counting from the birth of Yitzchak. Now we know that actually they were only slaves for 210 years. Okay? And because for whatever reason, either Hashem took them out before they stooped to the 50th level of Tumah, or because Bnei Yisrael kept certain things and were worthy to go out earlier, so that the the Nevuah 400 started earlier. Okay? So Rashi reconciles the 430 years, that's if you start counting from the Brisbane Absurdim. When that happened, that's when the 430 years starts to tick, and that's when the Torah said they were sitting in Mitzrayim 430 years. It means from the time they were told about being in Mitzrayim. And the 400-year prophecy, because of good behavior, it started earlier from the death, from the birth of Yitzchak. Excuse me, the birth of Yitzchak. Now, okay? Now, how old was Abraham when Yitzchak was born?
100.
Very good. 100. That means the Bris Hamas Ben Absarim took place when how old was Abraham?
99.
100. Minus 30, because 430. Birth of Yitzchak. Minus 30. Sorry, I told you, you have to remember calculus, right? 4 is 70. We have a problem here. Bris Ben Absarim happens later on in the Parsha. He's 70. Beginning of the Parsha, he's 75. Now, not so difficult, because you can say, Ein Mukdam Mucham B'Torah. We have a concept that not everything in the Torah is in chronological order. However, where did the Bris Ben Absarim take place? In Eretz Yisrael. This is a problem. One second. He's at 70, at age 70, he was in Israel getting the promise that you're going to receive this land and you're going to be slaves in a foreign land. He was 70. At 75, he's told, Lech Lecha, go to Eretz Yisrael. What? That does not make any sense. You cannot escape this question. You cannot escape this question. This is a very, very difficult question. One of the most difficult questions I've ever encountered on the Torah. We're going to try to solve this question. But I'm admitting to you now that the question is stronger than the answer. Last question, question number 4. And that is, if you look at the Midrashim telling us about leading up, the story leading up to Avram being told Lech Lecha, we find the story of the Kivshon Ha'esh, the story of Avram's confrontation with Nimrod. Nimrod is the most powerful man in the world at the time. Okay? And he captures Avram. Avram destroyed the idols of his father. He mocks the idols, right? People come in, like the story of the novice pharmacist, right? Terach says, I got to step out for a minute, you'll take care of things. Yeah, no problem. Avram says, I'll cover. I know the business. People come in and says, okay, I like that idol over there. And he says, what, you want that idol? Why do you want that idol? That's a little idol. You want the big idol. The big idol is stronger than the little idol. And then he says, well, why do you want this idol? What can this idol do? You're older than this idol. And he's making fun of the whole concept of idolatry. And he's losing customers. And Terach is really upset. And Terach takes his own son to Nimrod and says, can you knock some sense into him? And he says, okay, either you bow down to the god of fire, or I will throw you into the fire, to the Kivshon Ha'esh. Now Avram goes with his brother Haran. The two of them are going together to Nimrod. And the Medrash Tanchuma says that the entire time Haran is saying, I'm gonna see what, you know, because he's under the influence of Avram. And he says, if Avram wins, I'll be with the God of Avram. And if Nimrod wins, I'll go with him. What do we call those kind of people? Front runners. Okay. We don't like those kinds so much. Now, so Avram says, fine, I'll go into the Kivshon Ha'esh. Goes to the Kivshon Ha'esh, you all know the story. Miracle happens, it comes out. Nothing happened to him. So then Nimrod turns to Haran and says, Haran, what say you? Whose side are you on? And Haran says, I'm with the God of Abraham. Throw him into the Kivshon Ha'esh. They throw him in. He gets burnt to a crisp. What do you see from this? Fire is hot. It burns. Keep away from fire, children.
I don't understand, what's the problem?
Why does Haran not live? Why does Avram live and Haran not live? Question number 4. So what do you say? Why does Haran not live? Is there not the God of Abraham? Where was the God of Abraham when Haran went into the Kibshon HaEsh?
Why does Haran die, fellas in the back over here? Why does Haran die and Avram live? What do you say? Judah.
Didn't really believe in Hashem. But he says, now he believes in God. He saw the miracle. He believes in God. say better.
He needed to see to believe in God. He didn't see.
Okay. Good. Say stronger. Yeah, Judah.
Right.
The son of Eliot. There was originally there was a doubt. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, Josh. No leap of faith. Okay. Yeah. Leo.
Actually willing to die.
Oh, but that's what I'm looking for. You're all saying good. I'm not saying you're not good. But what Leo, when Avram walked in, he thought he was going to die. He was ready to give his life for God. When Haran went in, he thought he was going to live. And the natural thing that happens when you go into Kibshon HaEsh is that you don't live. It's the difference. The difference of between Avram and Haran is the difference between living and dying. Avram lived his life with conviction. You know what that means, my friends? To live your life with a conviction? To be willing to die for something you believe in? Haran did not live his life with a conviction. And a life lived without conviction, it's like you're dead already. It's not living. As has been mentioned here, and if you're yesterday the news was focused on obviously on Rav Avadya Yosef and his leaving this world. But if you maybe saw some of the tweets or Facebook posts, or yesterday, October 7th, was the English date of the outbreak of the Yom Kippur War 40 years ago. We spoke about the Yom Kippur War and Yom Kippur, but there's a lot of on Saturday night they had a whole program on Israeli TV, which I don't have, but I was told they had a whole program about. The Yom Kippur War there's so much to be said about it, because there's a lot of controversy surrounding the Yom Kippur War, because although we were surprised, a lot of the Mossad people who now are allowed to talk, they say we were not surprised at all. The Golda Meir, who was the Prime Minister at the time and top echelon, certainly all the people in the higher echelons of the intelligence, they knew exactly what was going to happen. They just were surprised at the results. But there was a certain hubris. There was a certain hubris? Better word for hubris? No better word for hubris. Arrogance. Certain arrogance that the Israelis had, that they were invincible after 67. We lost, as I mentioned in Yom Kippur, we lost close to 3,000 soldiers. Many of them were religious soldiers. Many of them were yeshiva students. Two books that I recommend you read this year. One is Adjusting Sights, In Hebrew, it's called Tiyum Kavanot. It's written by Rav Chaim Sabato. Rav Chaim Sabato is a Rebbe, a Ram, Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshivat Malei Adumim. And he's written a number. He's a very, very popular author here in Israel. Again, a religious person, rabbi. He also put out two years ago, a book, Conversations with Avraham Lichtenstein. I also recommend that. I don't think it's been translated yet to English, has it? But Adjusting Sights is his story, his personal story about the Yom Kippur War. And in his book, he tells about his tank mate, a fellow named Dov Indig, who was in Yeshiva Keren Biavne at the time, and was called up. He was 21 years old, called up to fight, hold off the Syrians in Emek HaBacha. You must have heard a little bit about it when you went up north, I imagine. Did you talk about it? No? Yeah. Har Bental, overlooking Syria?
Yes.
So, not about him specifically, but about that battle. And just a few tanks held off. Hundreds and hundreds. They were outnumbered in a ridiculous, over 100-to-1 ratio. And miraculously, they somehow managed to hold them off. And even got as far as to shooting onto Damascus. Everyone talks about the miracles of 67, but the 73 was perhaps no less of a miracle, considering how vulnerable we were, how close they were to just overtaking the entire state of Israel. And the fact that we were able to push them back and get as far as Damascus in the north and destroy Egypt in the south after we got walloped is no less miraculous. Dov Indig was his tank mate. And on Yud Aleph Tishrei, the day after Yom Kippur, he was called up that afternoon, that night. He was already in his tank. The next day, he was dead. Dov Indig was dead. And this was such a special person. Besides what was described in that book, Adjusting Sights, about Dov, and I'm sorry to give you a spoiler alert, but he dies. A book came out subsequently in 2005. Some of you may have seen it. It's been translated to English. It's called Letters to Talia. Anyone read that book? Letters to Talia? Okay. Another book you should read. In Hebrew, Mechtavim LeTalia, Letters to Talia by Dov Indig, who was just published about 10 years ago, less than 10 years ago, after the interest in this person, Dov, after Rav Chaim Sabato's book, which won all kinds of prizes here in Israel. So a friend of his, a guy by the name of Chagai Ben Arzi, who's a well-known educator in Israel, who was a very close friend of Dov, collected letters that Dov had written, correspondence that he had with a girl who is on a non-religious kibbutz up north. But a long story short, Dov had met this girl's father and some training in the army, and this guy was impressed by Dov and his knowledge of Judaism and the Torah, and he said that I have a daughter who's in high school who just participated in a seminar where they met religious students, they exchanged ideas, and she became interested in learning about certain things. She has a lot of questions, and I'm not able to answer her. I'm ignorant when it comes to the Torah and Judaism. So would you be willing to just, you know, to answer questions? She'll write to you, you write back. There were no emails, there were no texting, there was nothing, there were real letters they would send in the mail. And that's what happened. For the next 2 years, they wrote letters back and forth. She was a junior in high school, he was in Yeshiva Keren Biavne. And he also was in the during that time he was stationed in Sinai with his tank battalion. And they corresponded. And it's an amazing, amazing book about the arguing. It's like a Dama Shatashiv. Know how to answer mostly a lot about the religious Zionist philosophy. If you have questions about Torah Judaism and want to know how to answer them to others, specifically religious Zionist philosophy versus secular Zionist philosophy, This is an excellent book. It has a lot of wonderful qualities. But you read this, and you read, this guy was awesome. He was so, first of all, just expressed himself so beautifully, and so on the money. He had great answers to her questions, and she's buying into it. She's buying into his arguments. And unfortunately, the last letter she writes to him is Erev Yom Kippur. And she has this bad premonition that something bad is happening, going to happen, and that's it. That was the last letter that was sent. Letters to Talia. Dov Indig is an example of somebody, and there are many, many examples of this. Example of somebody who lived his life with conviction. He believed deeply in what he was doing. He was so proud that he was a soldier in the Israeli army, and at the same time, a yeshiva student here learning in Israel. He felt that he represented the best of the best of the Jewish people. Safra b'Saifa, both a man of the book and a man of the sword, willing to give his life for the Jewish people. Now, happens to be a story that I told last year, towards the end of the year, and you'll probably hear me tell this again because it's a story that's very close to me, but I think this is an appropriate place to share it with you. And that is that my family, my grandmother comes from Czechoslovakia, and she and her brothers had a close family friend whose name is Elisha Birnbaum, who came here with one of her brothers, came here on youth aliyah. If you know what that is, that a lot of parent families in Europe sent their children ahead. While the families are still back in Europe, send them ahead to Israel in the 30s. Feeling that something terrible was brewing, they sent them ahead and they set them up here in kibbutzim, in yeshivot. And he arrived here into Yeshivat Kfar Oel, a place where we visited last year, near Netanya, which is the first Bnei Akiva high school yeshiva. Got married here, raised a family. He had a son named Saril Birnbaum. Now, Elisha Birnbaum was, he shared the story with me, he was once driving, his son, Saril Birnbaum, was a madrich here, and this wasn't here yet, but in BMT. I mentioned this morning, BMT was in this building. Before it was in this building, it was in Rechavia. And he was a madrich, he was an Israeli student. He was learning at the time in Hebrew University. He had been the first student of Gush Etzion when they first started yeshiva. He was from that first group of students. And he was already out of yeshiva. Starting university, he was a madrich in yeshivat BMT. I don't know if Shmuel Noller knows, but he actually has a connection to this person. You know what I'm talking about? Okay. Now, Saril Birnbaum, unfortunately, was killed also on Yud Aleph Tishrei. On the 11th of Tishrei, he was also killed in a tank in the Golan Heights. Now, years later, Elisha Birnbaum was driving on the highway from Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim, and he sees a guy with his finger out looking to get a tramp. Stops, sees a guy, it's in a tan uniform, stops the car, and he has a kippah on his head. And he gets in the car, and he's like, what's pshat here? What? Tan uniform? Anyone know what that is? Tan uniform?
Air Force.
Okay, you know the story. Air Force. Keep on his head. And he said, and then he starts talking to me. Here's an American accent. He says, how does an American religious person get into the Air Force? Very rare to have a religious person in the Air Force in those days. Today, it's much more common. In those days, very uncommon, and an American on top of it. So he said, what's your story? He said, I'll tell you, I was in my year in Israel, and I was in BMT. And they took us, when we were during our year, they took us to Har Herzl, which we're going to do as well, on Yom HaZikaron, on Israeli Remembrance Day. Right before, the day before Yom HaTzmaut, is Yom HaZikaron. Mm-hmm. And we go, we also join thousands, tens of thousands of Jews to Har Herzl, which is a few minutes from here. And we go and we stand by grave sites. And some of you will, maybe you'll join me and we'll stand by the gravesite of Sariel Birnbaum. And they took us to the gravesite of different people, different soldiers that had lost their lives. And after the ceremony, we spoke to the family. And they were telling us about their son. And I was listening. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, you know, okay, I was planning on going back to the States, back to Queens College, you know, just like every other American boy who was here for the year, had a great time, going back. But then I heard about their son and how he was willing to give his life. I'm saying, what am I going to do? What am I going to do for the Jewish people? And that's when I decided that I want to also join the army. And what a high profile. I had a gibush, I got into tayasim, and got into to pilot, so on and so forth, and here I am. So Elisha Berman turns to me and goes, do you remember the name of the family that you were standing by? He says, I don't remember the name of the family, but I remember his name, the boy's name, because it was a very unique name. His name was Sariel. That was my son. Some of you from TABC and those of you who've been to his hockey camp know Rabbi Sariel Militsky. He's named after this person, Sariel Birnbaum. Because his uncle was in BMT and was close to this madrich. And when his parents had a child, they didn't have anyone to name after, but he had such an influence on his uncle, decided to name their son after Sariel Birnbaum. That's living a life of conviction. That's the difference between Avraham and Haran. Now, in that book that I mentioned earlier, Letters to Talia, one of the things that he talks about, and he's quoting, paraphrasing Rav Kook, is that in contrast to the secular Zionists, who believe that the value of Israel, the value of the state of Israel, is that it is a haven for us. It's a place for us to run to. There was the Holocaust, and we didn't have a place to go to. And now we have a place that we go to. When we're persecuted in different parts of the world, now we have a place we can go to. And that's what the secular Zionists believe. The value of Israel is that now we have a place our own. They can't kick us out of here. We have a place we can go to, a place to be our own bosses. And that's important. But Rav Kook says, Chas v'shalom, to say that is the value, the only value of Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is not only a means to an end. Because according to that philosophy, and the idea was maybe to create a new Jewish state in Madagascar. Right? It doesn't have to be here. Nothing unique to this place. It could be somewhere else. It happens to be this place because we have a claim here. But if someone's willing to say, forego your claim here, the Arabs that are here, they'll still here. You'll go and we won't bother you in Madagascar. You're okay with that? So there were many Zionists that said, yeah, we're okay with that. We'll take it. We'll take what we can get. But Rav Kook writes, and it's his first thing in Sefer Orot, first paragraph, that Eretz Yisrael has a value in and of itself. It is not just a haven for us. It's intrinsic to the Jewish people. We cannot be anywhere else. Rav Benny Eisner, Zatzal, we spoke about this morning. One of the things he always would say, and if you listen to his recordings, they have it on the YU Torah on our website, he always used to give a mashal of a Jew in Chutz Laretz is like a tiger in the Bronx Zoo, a koala bear in the Bronx Zoo. It's not his natural habitat. He's locked in a cage. He's not living a normal life. Okay, yeah, he's eating and drinking. You know, they're taking care of him, maybe. But that's not real living. An animal has to live in its natural habitat to really live life to its fullest. And a Jew in Chutz La'aretz is not living life to its fullest. He's living a castrated life. It's only in Israel where he's in his natural habitat. The Jewish people in Israel are one. This is where we truly live. Now, when I was teaching different yeshiva, there was parents were visiting their son, and I happened to know them well. They were from the neighborhood that I grew up in, and I was talking to them, and they were telling me that their son was interesting, saying second year. He's talking about living in Israel, and they thought he was crazy. He's gone crazy. He wants to live here. And the father said, and I quote, he said, "I would never live in this country. The only way you're going to get me in this country is if I come in a box." And Neboth wasn't that much longer until he came here in a box. But that's the mentality of some Jews in America. Some Jews, religious Jews, who love Israel. We love Israel. Of course we're Zionists. But to live here, it's crazy, ridiculous. Is it? Rav Kook says it's the only natural place for a Jew. It's intrinsic to Judaism. It's the only place you can truly live as a Jew. So you see, that's the pshat in that very difficult question. That very difficult question that we mentioned. Why is the Torah, how is it possible that the Torah tells us that Avram was told Lech Lecha at 75, but he was already in Israel at age 70 getting the bris ben hapsarim? How can you make sense of that? So here's what I think the pshat is. Is that yes, it's true that Avram came to Israel when he was 70. But that's a continuation of the end of Parshas Noach. If you read the end of Parshas Noach, they're running away. Terach and his sons are running away. They're running away because Nimrod is after them. So they're running. And where they're running to? They're running to Eretz Canaan. Now Terach dies and they stop in Haran, not to be confused with Haran. Haran is the brother who died. Haran is the place where they stop, and that's where Terach dies. Vayikach Terach is Avram beno, Bes Lot ben Aaron ben beno, Bes Sarai kolatoish is Avram beno, Vayetzu itam eor kazdim lalechet, Arza Knan, Vayavo ad Haran Vayeshvu sham. Torah tells us that they were running away. They come to Haran, they settle there for a moment. Terach dies. But Avram and Sarai and Lot, they continue running. Terach dies there, but they continue running. And at age 70, he gets to Israel. And Hashem appears to him, and he gives him the bris ben hapsarim. But then they go back. They go back. They leave Eretz Yisrael. Why do they leave Eretz Yisrael? They leave Eretz Yisrael. Why? Not sure. So actually, I sugi here.
Ridiculous.
Back to our sugi here. We the Torah wants us to understand that message. That we have to live a life of conviction, which means to go to Eretz Yisrael as lechatchila. Not, I need to go I need a place to run to escape to run away from. But we go there, the Torah says, Lech Lecha to Avram. The man who lives a life with conviction goes there with conviction. And now let's answer the last questions, which we're going to do it very briefly. You know, it needs more time. The last two questions were, why doesn't the Torah tell us about Avram's journey to finding God? And why does the Torah tell us this introduction to Noah, but it doesn't tell us the introduction to Avram? We don't know anything about Avram from the Torah. And the answer, I believe, is that the Torah does not tell us how Avram finds God. And all the stories about the Kiddushin Eish doesn't tell us those stories. It's because had the Torah told us those stories, then that is the way that each one of us would have to find God. If the Torah told us how Avram found God, then that's the way we would also have to find God. What's written in the Torah is not just a story, but it is mechayev, it's obligatory. And as the Torah told us how we found God, then that's the way we'd also have to find God. The Torah left it out. Specifically because there are many, many paths to God. There is not one path. Some person will find God through intellectual pursuit. Another person will find God through seeing the beauty of the world. Another person will find God from an emotional experience, from a miraculous experience. Another person will find God from seeing a creation, a birth, from being at the birth of his child. There are many, many different paths. And each one has to follow his own path to God. Avram found his own path to God. And the truth is that the machlokas between that he was 3 or 48, it could be that they both agree. That when he was 3 years old, he understood God on one level, and then he was 48, he was on a different level. He got to God through a different path. It's not a stira. It's not a contradiction. And the Torah leaves it out. Because we can all find our own path to Hashem. And finally, the Torah doesn't tell us, doesn't give us any introduction to Avraham, that he was a tzaddik, and that's why Hashem chose him. It's because, as the Zohar teaches us, quoted by the Sfas Emes, the Ger Rebbe, an unbelievable Zohar, and this will end. One of my personally favorite pieces of Torah, and that is that the truth is that God did not choose Avraham by saying to him, Lech lecha me'artzecha mo'aretzecha me'beis avicha. But rather, says the Zohar, God calls out to everyone. He called out to everyone during Avraham's time. Everyone got the call of Lech Lecha. Everyone got the call. And the difference between Avraham and everybody else was not because God chose them. It's because that Avraham heeded the call of God. And Zohar says something further. He says, not only during the time of Avraham is there a call of Lech Lecha, but in every generation, in every time, and every single one of us gets the call of Lech Lecha. At some point in our life, it could be right now. Lech Lecha. Go for yourself. Go to Him. Get up and go. Kadosh Baruch Hu is calling out to you. And the difference between Avraham and everyone else is that he listened and heeded the call. He lived his life with conviction, went to Eretz Israel, and he began the Jewish people, and we're forever grateful. Have a good evening. Take chairs with you. Tomorrow we'll give out the masa beds. Rav Elmeli locked me out of his office.